Okay, we're starting here on the top of Samach Vav Amud Aleph. The Gemara here is trying to understand what the difference is between the two brachot that we brought yesterday. One brachot, which takes the names of each of the chagavim, and then tells us that Lemino Limineu also includes something similar to that item. And then we have another brachot that seems to have a much broader scope on what it's willing to include. And then we had Rav Chai's modification or explanation of that at the end of yesterday. So we'll get back into this in a second and we'll explain both of the shitot, because the Gemara here is going to slowly lay out what's the distinction between them and what's the methodology that they are using. Gemara wants to know between these two brachot, b'maika miflegei, what is the nafkamina between the two brachot? There's got to be some difference when you have these two different limudim that results in a outcome halachically that is different. The Gemara says, Tana debei Rav, Vitana debei Rabbi Shmuel. So Tana debei Rav, over here Rashi says that it comes from the Midrash Halacha on Vayikra, that it was called the Sifra debei Rav, and debei Rav is Shlevi Shaya Shagur beBeit Midrash Befi Kulam. Bei Rav means from the Beit Midrash. This is the Midrash Halacha that's found in the Beit Midrash that everybody's familiar with. On the other hand, you have a Tana debei Rabbi Ishmael, which not everybody is familiar with. Only the Talmidim of Rabbi Shmuel were familiar with it. So that's the difference between Tana Debei Rav, which is like a generic Midrash Halacha, versus the Tana Debei Rabbi Shmuel, which was particular to the school of Rabbi Ishmael. That's the way Rashi explains it. If you look at the Rambam in the introduction to Mishnah Torah, he calls the Tana Debei Rav, or the Sifra, the Torah Kohanim, because Rav was the Misader. He's the one who put it together, similar to the way that Rabbi put together the Mishnah, so do Rav put together this Torah Kohanim, and therefore it's called Tana Debei Rav, because of Rav, the person, not because of the generic Tana Debei Rav being the Beit Midrash. There are two different ways to view it, but anyway, that brayta that is not the Tana Debei Rav Yishmael is the Torah Kohanim. It's a Stam brayta that everybody was familiar with and found in Torah Kohanim. And then we have Tana Debei Rav Yishmael. They argue Berosho Aroch Kamiflege. They argue about whether a Chagav that has the four features, plus it has a longer head or longer neck, is that included in the kosher chagavim? According to Tana Debei Rav, it will not be included. According to Tana Debei Rav Yishmael, it will be included. So now, how does that work? Tana Debei Rav Sabar. So Tana Debei Rav, and this is what we spoke about when we began this section in yesterday's daf, that asher lo karayim, that the beginning of the pasuk is, achet zet tochlu, mikol sheret zehof. That is a klal. So that would be an inclusive term. Arbe, salam, chagol, chagav, limineu, prat. All of those items are details about the klal that we had before. Then you have what otherwise is known as a klal uprat, one of the 13 midot of Rabbi Yishmael. And ein b'chlal elamasher b'prat. The school of thought of klal uprat says that whatever is a detail is an explanation of the klal. And therefore, when you have a klal uprat, the prat is coming to define for you. It's coming to tell you what the klal is. And so therefore, when you have the list of the chagavim afterwards, they are limiting the klal to these items that are enumerated. It's as if it wrote colon, and then it said these items afterwards. So it gives you the generic statement, and then puts colon, and then it says, here are the items that are subsumed under this category. So that is a klal uprat. Now, even leminehu includes as being a prat. De mine in, de lab de mine lo. That which is its species or that particular type is included. Something that is not included. And the way Rashi writes it says, hilka chad mechavrei loati. Therefore, you can't learn one from the other. You can't learn out salam from arve and chargol. Each one has its own particular features. And those particular features, we demand over here that you have them in order for it to be included in the category. So for instance, the arveh, which we said yesterday, has the feature of ein lo gabachat, ein lo zanav, ein rosho aroch. You've got to match up with all of those features in order for it to be subsumed under the arveh. Two possibilities of how to read this. We'll come back and discuss it afterwards, but I'll point them out. One is to say that there are only 8 items that are included. There's the 4 items that are enumerated. And each one of them has a limino and the mineu. So that would include another 4 items that are similar. It's a riboy that includes things that are similar to the original item. The other way to learn it is that all the mino and mineu does is says that you have to be exactly like the paradigmatic statement on the other side, which is the arbeh, the salam, the chargol, and the chagav. As long as you are identical to them, then you can be included. So it wouldn't be a limitation of 8 items. It'd be 4, plus whatever you could fit exactly into that category that would work. But what is clear, and this is what we noted before, all of them have this in common, which is that Ein Rosh Ha'aruch. That means with Rosh Ha'aruch, you're not going to fit into any of these categories, and that's why you're not included, according to Tana de Bei Rav. Umarbi, the Dami Le Mishneit Stadim. Therefore, he includes things that are similar to it, Mishneit Stadim. Now, there are some Girsot that don't have this in there, because the idea of something similar, Mishneit Stadim and Sadechat, is usually invoked when you have a Klal Uprat Uklal. It says the Prat in the middle that is including Ke'ena Prat. Do you need Ke'ena Prat Mishneit Stadim, or do you need Ke'ena Prat only Mitzad Echad? So that's generically or generally where that term is used. Over here, they're applying it to the Klal Uprat, and that may be what I was just explaining to you, the two possibilities of how to explain what is being done over here by Tana de Bei Rav when the Mineyu. It's not simply including just one item per each of them. Rather, it's including things that are similar, but similar in every way possible. And the terminology, Mishneit Stadim and Sadechad, Tosafot, there's a massive Tosafot from yesterday's and through today's daf over here that discusses this idea of Shneit Stadim, Tzadechad. Sometimes the Gemara says Shloshat Stadim, Shneit Stadim. So Tosafot comes up with a general principle, which is it has to do with the level of commonality or significance of the prat that you're discussing. They used it yesterday for the four items. Yesterday we said that there are four items that are in common between all of these Chagavim, which are the Simanim that are mentioned in the Mishnah, which are four legs, four wings, covers the robe of the body, and the jumpers. Those four items, the Gemara never questions that they're included. Things like Rosh Ha'aruch, Zanav, Gabachat, the Gemara is willing to dispense with when you move through the different examples that are brought here. So why is it that one, the Gemara has no question about, and the other one it does? Second of all, if you're going to believe that it's Ke'ena Prat, even if you say Mishneit Stadim, it's got to be like it in two ways. That's four simanim plus another four simanim. So what Tosafot says is that we rank the commonalities or the items that are in the prat. Some of them are what we call chashuv. They're important. They're fundamental types of simanim. And then we have other items that are less fundamental type items. They're not integral to the item, either because there are no such items that exist, or they're possibly something that is a feature, but is not integral to the definition of the item. So when we say over here that you have to have Mishneit Stadim, it means that you have to have the commonality between them, both on the Ikar integral features, which means the four Simanim, and then the ancillary type things. They also have to be similar in that fashion. So you have to include all the four Simanim, because that's something that is inherent to the item, and therefore to include it, you'll need those. And number two is you're going to need even the other features like Zanav, Gabachat, Rosh Ha'aruch. All of those features, even though they're ancillary, and Tosafot calls them Garua, they are Simanim Garua. They're not inherent to the item, but they are defining of the item, and those will be only included when you are absolutely a stickler to make sure that it's Ke'ena Prat. And over here, that's what this view in the Tana de Bei Rav requires, is that you be identical to the Arveh, the Salam, the Chargon, Chalav. That means you're going to need the primary features, and the ancillary features are all going to have to match. And that's what it means, Mishneit Stadim, that you're going to need both sides. You're going to have all features that are included over here. That's the view of Tana de Bei Rav. But obviously, Tana de Bei Rav does not have anything to include Rosh Ha'aruch, because it includes Arveh, Salam, Chargon, and Chagav. And then we saw afterwards that the Gemara gave a list of four items, which was Tziporat HaKramim, Yochana Yushalmit, Artsuvia, and Haraz Banit, which were the four items that we included that matched up with them. And again, whether that means just those four items, or anything that would be subsumed identical to the features that we saw in each of those items. What's clear is Rosh Ha'aruch, we don't have any extraneous item that's there to include Rosh Ha'aruch. Tane de Bir Bishmol Savar, they hold Asher Lo Krayim Klal. That's the first klal, similar to Tane de Bir Rav. Arveh Salam Chagol Chagav Prat. So that's, again, similar, but missing one item, which is Limineyu. There, the Mineyu is Chazar Uchlal. That comes back to bring a klal on the other side. Klal Uprat Uchlal. Iyata Adan Elakeina Prat. Umarbe Chod Domile Bechad Sad. Therefore, it's willing to include anything that matches it, even in Bechatzad, even in one way. Meaning that over here we don't have the requirement that it be identical to the item, but rather it be similar to the item. Here, the similarity is that we require the four simanim, We don't require things like a bachat zanav. We're not going to be a stickler about those. So now, again, Tana de Beit Rabbi Shmuel, the way that we laid it out yesterday, so I'll just review it quickly, so we understand it, is that you have a klal, a prat, and a klal. We already said that you could have sufficed with a klal, prat, or klal of arbeh and chagol. Arbeh and chagol would have sufficed because they have offsetting features. Those offsetting features are gabachat and zanav, because the arbeh does not have a gabachat, does not have a zanav, and the chagol has a gabachat and has a zanav. So that shows you that those features are not important. Given that those features are not important because you have two items that are included that have those features in them, that by definition tells you that the common denominator between them are not those features. The common denominator are the four simanim that are brought in the Mishnah. That means anything with the four simanim would be included. And that means that the salam and the chagav would have been included. You didn't need to write either of those because, for instance, the salam has a gabachat and it doesn't have a zanav. So it's one feature of each the arbeh and the chagol. And therefore it should have been included because those features are not important. The only thing that you have that is common between them, which would have presented a problem, is ein rosh ha'aroch. They have that common denominator between them. And again, even according to Tana de Beit Rabbi Yishmael, we're saying that the klal kama is dafka, which means that you really start with a klal uprat. When you bring in the extra klal, that comes to include items, but they still got to be similar enough to this item. They've got to be really identical in a sense that it includes both the primary feature and the ancillary feature, as long as that ancillary feature is something that appears in all the items of the prat, so that we would include. If it's not something that's included in all those items, then it's wiped out because it's not a prat that's going to be important to us. But the one thing that does appear is ein rosh ha'aroch. That's what we said yesterday. That's what salam comes to deal with. Salam comes to tell you that through arbeh and chagol, you could have learned salam. Salam is extraneous now. Now it's extraneous. Salam comes to teach you einu inyan, the rosh einu aroch, because that we already have from the arbeh and the chagol. Therefore, it comes to teach you even rosh aroch will be included. Now, rosh aroch doesn't mean just rosh aroch. It means rosh aroch and the four simanim, because as Tosafot said again, that the four simanim are the primary items. The rosh aroch is a secondary or ancillary item, so the fact that you include it can't be standalone. Or we brought yesterday the Riva also mentioned the fact that there was no such a chagav that exists. You can't find a chagav that's defined as a chagav that doesn't have the four simanim. So inherent to them that you won't find that. You can find things that don't have these other ancillary features. You can't find them without the four simanim. For one of those two reasons, then you say aroch. That comes to tell you, when you say the salam, it comes to tell you that rosh aroch plus the four simanim is included, just like ein rosh aroch is included. Then we have leminehu, so that's also extraneous. The Ramban just says it's extraneous and leave it alone. The Bali Tosafot yesterday at the beginning of the daf spoke about leminehu coming to dispel possible havaminas. The Ramban says over there, because had it not written leminehu, havamina dafka b'min salam, shari rosh aroch. One possibility would you think that only in the world of salam is rosh aroch okay? The mineo comes to tell you that it's more expansive than that. Or the other possibility is, inami avamina to salam ataleh sormino. That comes to tell you that that would be a sur. And not to tell you that it's mutar. The mineo comes to say that it's coming to be matir and not to be oser. Then we have the word chagav. Chagav is also extraneous. That came to teach you that shmo chagav. It has to have the name chagav. So that's an additional requirement. It's not an inherent requirement. It's not a siman on the body, but it's got to have that name chagav, which means that misora, you need to know that it's called a chagav. And then mineu tells you that the name is not enough. You need the name and the simanim. You need both of them. So that was Tana de Beit Rabbi Shmuel, but the underlying core of his position is a klal uprat uchlau. And then through that klal uprat uchlau, you create a binyanav. So Tana de Beit Rabbi Shmuel, according to Rav Chai yesterday pointed out, is built on two premises. One is that it's a klal uprat uchlau, each one of them individually. And then there's a binyanav that you build from the two klal uprat uchlaus of arbeh and chagol, which were then included salam and chagav, and then they become extraneous. The way Rashi explained it yesterday is that klalei klalot pratei pratot means you still have a klal uprat uchlau of salam and chagav, and they're extraneous. You have a klal and a prat that are extraneous. What do you do with them? The Ramban is more circumspect about that and says that it's just a question about binyanav afterwards. Once you cross over from klal uprat uchlau to binyanav, klalei klalot means you use klal uprat uchlau, pratei pratot means that you use binyanav. So there's two mechanisms of limud, according to the Ramban. According to Rashi, means these extraneous klalim and pratim. And that's what led to the difference in the explanation. The Baal Tosafot, the Minehu of Salam, has to do something. According to the Ramban, the Minehu is just, it's extraneous, it's just a parallel structure in the Pasuk, but in the end it is extraneous, because he doesn't have this need to darshan every single word of the Klal Uprat afterwards. That's what Rav Chai was speaking about, that the Klal Uprat Uklal by itself was not enough, because of the common denominators between them. Rather, you build a Binyan Av through Arba and Chagol. Once you have that Binyan Av, you don't need Salam and Chagav. The extraneous Salam and Chagav give us the additional information, which is that we include now things that have Rosho Aroch, and we have to have the name Chagav associated with them, and that's what the Gemara just said now. Something with Rosho Aroch is the Nafka Mina between Tana Debei Rav and Tana Debei Rav Yishmael. Tana Debei Rav has no way to include Rosho Aroch, because he doesn't have any riboy that exists. He only is limited to what is mentioned in the Psukim, the names of the locusts, plus Mineo or Mino that's mentioned by each one of them, that includes something identical to it, but not differentiated from it. And Rosh Aruch is something that's differentiated. On the other hand, Tana Debei Yishmael has extraneous ribuyim, including Chasalam and Chagav, and that gives him the opportunity to include other items besides just what is particularly mentioned here, and that includes Rosho Aroch, and that's the nafkamina between them. Tosafot over here says, I don't really understand why Rosho Aroch is the only nafkamina between them. If you think about it just from a theoretical standpoint, Tana Debei Rav Yishmael includes so much more than Tana Debei Rav. Tana Debei Rav Yishmael includes anything that matches the features, the four simanim, would be included, as long as its name is Chagav. Whereas Tana Debei Rav is limited to 8 items, which we said before, and that would be a significant difference, irrespective of the Rosho Aroch or not Rosho Aroch issue. That's just one of many differences. So Tosfot asked that question. He says, why don't they offer other alternatives? He says, the Yesh Lomar gives two answers. One is, the Lekha Shum Chagav Shebo Hei Simanim Shelo Yimimin Otam Aktuvim B'matnitin. He says, one possibility is, nothing has these 5 Simanim that would actually show up that wasn't mentioned in the Mishnah. I mean, that we covered, whatever is going to have 5 simanim in it, we covered that already. Inami, rebuta nakat. They're telling you the chiddush. Tafila Rosh Aroch, shari tani debay Rabbi Shmuel. I mean, that's the chiddush of tani debay Shmuel. It doesn't just include Kein HaPrat, but because of the salam, it actually includes something that's not Kein HaPrat, which means Rosh Aroch. So there's an additional ribuy over here, through that binyanav that gives you the extraneous words. That's what's unique about tani debay Rabbi Shmuel. It's not to say there aren't other differences, but that's a huge chiddush of tani debay Rabbi Shmuel. So in one sense, Tosafot says, Enoch and Ami, there are more differences. This is just a chiddush, and therefore we highlighted this difference. And the first answer, he says, there aren't any other differences, because the items that we enumerated in the Mishnah, the 4 simanim, plus Rosh Aroch, Eno Aroch, that covers all locusts that are up there that are kosher, and therefore this really is the only nafkamina between them, because the 8 that are mentioned by Tana Debei Rav incorporate everything we need. And the only thing that they're left out is Rosh Aroch, and that's the differentiating factor that Tana Debei Yishmael has. So those are the two ways that Tosafot deals with it. Right now, the Gemara challenges this view of Tana Debei Yishmael, because you have an imbalance in the Klal Uprat Uklal. Baal lo dami, Klal Kama, the Klal Batro. The Klal Kama, the Klal in the beginning and the Klal in the end are very different. Klal Kama, Asher lo Karayim, Amar Rachmono. So the first pasuk says, "Achazet tochlo mikol sheretz oof alechal arba shelo krayim imal leraglav natarbein haaretz." That would include a lot of items in there. That's not really a strict definition. That's a very broad, encompassing heter to eat all these things that have krayim imal. That they have these jumpers. Deit lei achol. If they have them, you can eat them. Deit lei lo techol. If they don't have them, you can't eat them. Klala patra. The klala patra is limino liminehu ad shavu ba'arba simanim. Those are limited by the pratim that are mentioned there. And those pratim, once we have the binyan av, say that the 4 simanim are the limitations of what you can eat. So that means limino, limineu, only include things that have 4 simanim in common, whereas the first klal would include anything as long as they had these jumpers. If you had jumpers, you'd be fine. If you don't have jumpers, you'd not be fine. So there you have an imbalance in the klal upratu klal. The first klal would include so much more than the latter klal. That type of imbalance, that is the reason actually why Tana Debei Rav does not learn it as a klal uprat uklal, is because the latter klal is not similar to the first klal. And the Gemara is challenging Tana Debei Yishmael, how could you even invoke it as a klal uprat uklal? You have an imbalance in the klalim. The answer of the Gemara is Tana Debei Yishmael, but klal uprat ki hai gav nadoin. That's their style of limud. they are willing to create a klal pratu klal when there's an imbalance between the initial klal and the latter klal. Tana de Rav will not do that, and therefore they learned it as a klal uprat and not as a klal upratu klal. And then they use the mino and the mineyu as ribuim because they're not part of the klal upratu klal, and they included additional items that are identical to the pratim that were there. On the other hand, Tana de Yishmol says even when you have an imbalance in the klalim, we're willing to learn it as a klal uprat uklal. And therefore, you get to the limudim that came out of the Tana Debei Rabbi Shmuel. Udamrinu nami ba'alma, the dying Tana Debei Rabbi Shmuel, b'klali uprateki, I gav nami hocha. And anywhere else in Shas, or anywhere else in the Midrash Halacha, where you see Tana Debei Shmuel doing this, learning something where there's an imbalance in the klal kama and the klal batra, the source is over here. This is where we see that Tana Debei Rabbi Shmuel is willing to do such a thing. This is the paradigmatic klal upratu klal to tell you that that type of limud, according to them, is fine. And that's how they get to their limud, and that's really the distinction between Tana Debei Shmuel and Tana Debei Rav. The nafka mina is Rosh HaAruch. The key difference in their shitot is whether, when you have an imbalance in the klal kama and the klal batra, do you darshan that as a klal uprat uklal, or just as a klal uprat, because the latter klal is not really another klal to be included as a klal uprat uklal. Then Rashi over here makes a comment, V'chagavim alalu ein tonuin shchita. These chagavim do not have a requirement of Shchita, Sharei Achar Dagim Iskarem HaKaduv. The Pasuk mentions them after the Dagim. He's quoting something, as the Tosafot points out, from the Halachot Gedolot. The Baal Halachot Gedolot says this. But Tosafot says he doesn't know why Rashi went that way, except for the fact that that comes from a Pasuk, which is pretty convincing that there is such a limud. But nevertheless, he says, Shas is replete with statements that Chagavim don't need Shchita. Gemara in many places talks about Muksa or other problems with Chagavim, but never worries about the issue that you need it to shecht it, or that it needs to be dead. The truth is, it only has to be dead, because otherwise you violate Baal Tashaksu, meaning that's not proper to eat something that's alive, but not because of Eber Minachai. So the Shechita is not a necessary requirement for Chagavim, but they learn it out from the summary Pasuk at the end of the Parshiyah of Shmini, which is, so Zotrat HaBeimah, that was the animals. Those are the Mafrisei Parsa, the Shosa Shetza. Velf, those are regular birds. The list of Tamei birds, and the other ones are Kshirim. V'chol nefesh ha-chayaru meset b'mayim. Those are the fish. U'l'chol nefesh ha-shoretzet al-aretz. And then there are the Shvatzim al-aretz. There are no Shvatzim al-aretz that are kosher, except for the Shvatzei ha-of, which are the locusts. So now, why would that teach you any information? That is because it's different than the order in the Parshiot. In the order of the Parshiot, the animals first, then the fish, then the birds, and then the locusts. And so it switches in that summary pasuk, it switches around the fish and the birds. Why did it change the order? That's the drush of the Baal Halachot Gedolot to tell you, just like fish don't require shechita, they can just be pulled from the water and eaten, so too, the locusts do not require shechita. And that's what Rashi teaches over here, that din, or brings that Baal Halachot Gedolot, that there is no requirement of shechita on the locust. There's not even a requirement that you kill them, Ella, that you're going to be in violation of Baal Tzeshaksu if you eat them alive, and therefore you need to kill them just to avoid that Isur, but not because there's an inherent need to kill them in order to eat them. It's improper to eat them while they're alive, and therefore you need to kill them. Once they're dead, you can eat them. It doesn't matter how they died or how they were killed. They're available to you to be eaten just like fish, and they have no requirement of shechita, unlike Behema and Oath that do have a requirement of shechita. Amamar Ishmael Chagav, Yakol Ishmael Chagav, just going back to the Tana Debei Ishmael, the extraneous part of Chagav and the Mineyu that is associated with it, there we said, Yakol Ein Bo Kol HaSimanim Alalu, you would think that if it just has the name Chagav, that would have been okay. You don't need the other Simanim. Tamalomer LeMineyu, Aje Bo Kol HaSimanim Alalu, therefore you need all the Simanim plus Chagav. Ein Bo Kol HaSimanim Alalu, Mehechitete, where are you going to come out with this idea that you can have anything without all of those simanim? Arbe v'chargol k'tiv. You already have things that are defining for you what is mutar. How could you now make a suggestion that the word chagav at the end there, which is extraneous, now comes to teach you that if it's called chagav, forget about everything else we learned until now, you can just eat it because it's called a chagav. Doesn't it say before we built the binyanav on arbe and chagol? Arbe and chagol tell you that you need these four simanim. Those were the common denominators between them. And that told you we'd include anything with four simanim. How can you suddenly drop the necessity for four simanim and say, oh, we'll just include anything that's called a chagav? Where it says, ilok tiv salam kidamart. Had it not written salam, you're right. Had the only extraneous word been chagav, then you'd be bound by the arven chagol telling you you need four simanim, chagav telling you you need the name. That would mean you need the name and the four simanim. Salam opens up Pandora's box, because hasha dichtiv salam le'ribuye Rosh Aruch. Now that you opened up salam to say that even Rosh Aruch is included, which means that we no longer are just bound by the four simanim, all of a sudden we open up this possibility that other things can be included. Emal lirbe nami koldu. Let us also include koldu. Koldu means here afilu do dami leo b'chad siman. Even if it's not similar to it, even with one siman. Because now we see that salam, you don't need all the pratim to be equal, because it allows Rosh Aruch in, which wasn't allowed before. All of a sudden, Rosh Aruch got in. So maybe you just need some commonality between them. You don't need such strict commonality between them. Kamash Malan, therefore, it comes along Chagav and Limineu to tell you that it has to be all the simanim plus Chagav in order to be considered a locus. Maishna Hotam Damart Salam Zerashon. How come the Tana de Rav and the Tana de Rabbi Shmuel, when they were translating the words into Aramaic, they translated these words differently? One Braita translated it Salam as Rashon and Chagol as Nipul, and Maishna Ocha, and then the other Braita, Damart Salam Ze Nipul, Chagol Ze Rashon. I mean, they just flipped the definitions of Arbe and Chagol. Why do they give different Aramaic translations to the words? My answer is Makiatre or Makiatre. They're actually the same thing, it's just what they called them in their location. So it was not that they were speaking about different species, or they were arguing about the species, it's just that in the area of Tana de Bei Rav, they called the Salam Rashon, and they meant Salam. That's the species they were speaking about. And in Tana de Bei Rav, in their area, they had the Chagol was called the Nipul, but they meant Chagol. Then you go to Tana de Bei Rishmon, in their location, they called the Salam Nipul, but they meant Salam. So for them, Nipul is the same as Rashon for the Tana de Bei Rav. And then Chagol, they call it the Rashon. That Rashon is the same as the Nipul of the Tana de Bei Rav. They're both speaking about a Chagol. So it's just a language difference in the location as to what they call those items, but there's not a fundamental difference between them in the translation of the words. So they're speaking about the same species, they're speaking about the same type. They have no distinction between them, except this is the way they spoke about it, or that's the translation they had in their location, and that's the translation they had in their location, but they were speaking about the same species, the same min, they just translated it differently in those two locations, and they flipped the translations. Alright, now we're moving on to fish. We finished behemot, we finished the birds, we finished the locusts, now we're on to the fish, and we know that the requirements of the fish are pretty straightforward, because the Torah lays out what the defined simanim are, similar to Behema, where it gives you it explicitly, it's snapir v'kaskeset. Fins and scales are the requirement. We saw that in the Mishnah, and then we saw that the scales are the things that stick to the body, meaning that there are the scaly material that's on the body of the fish, and the fins are the things that they use to swim with. Now, it's true that there are numerous fins on a fish, even a non-kosher fish might have fins. The fins that we're speaking about are the side fins, the ones that they used to shat b'mayim, that they used to float in the water, to swim in the water. Not the necessarily, there can be dorsal fins, there can be tail fins, meaning that there are other fins on the fish. The fins that we're speaking about are the fins that allow it to move and to swim in the water. All right, so now the Gemara says, Ubedagim, koshiesh no snapir, because guess it? Tanra banan, ein lo achshav, batidim legadel acher zman. If it does not have fins and scales now, but it will grow them in the future, they will come to be on the fish. When it's young, it doesn't have them. Later on, it will have them. Kagon, and it gives examples of that. Of the sultanit, vapian. So again, I'm going to give you loose translations of these items. Rashi over here says that sultanit means dagim tanim. These are small fish. Balaz, he calls them tunina. Tuna is a larger fish. It's not a small fish. It could be speaking about the tunny fish, but even the tunny fish is a decent-sized fish. It seems that the sultanit is probably in the sardine family. The way that it's translated is the sultanit was sprat, and the apion was sardines. So I'm saying they'd be sprat and sardines, which are both very small fish, and when they're first born, they do not have the scales. As they develop, they get their scales. Harize mutar. Both of them are mutar, meaning that even though they didn't have them at the time of birth, since they grew them later on, that's sufficient to make it into something that's mutar. to answer your question, seems to be that we're thinking about the scales developing later. And the truth is that the Gemara is going to say in a second that the scales are the only thing that matters. Because by definition, if you have scales, you have fins. So the Gemara says in the end, the only key element is whether they have scales or not. So in all likelihood, they're speaking about scales here. And that means that even if they don't have them now, but they have them after time, they grow the scales after time as they develop into bigger fish, that makes them into a kosher fish. How is it mutar? Yesh lo achshav, if it has scales now, va'atid ha'shiran, but it will lose them in the future, b'shash olam min ha'mayim, when it leaves the water, or maybe when it grows older, they are lost in that way. Kigong, and now it gives examples of that. Akonis, aponis, kasitifas, and achsaptipias, v'atunas. According to Rashi, these are Persian words. The truth is that the Gemara more likely is using Greek words or the Greek names of these fish. And I'll give you again the loose definitions of them. The okanos is likely to be the coleus fish. The apunas is likely to be scamper fish or mackerel. The kasaptias is very controversial because the Greek word that this represents is a sword. And in all likelihood, this is a reference to swordfish. And it is a major halachic controversy with regards to swordfish. But it seems for many generations and many hundreds of years, they did eat the swordfish. Because of this Gemara, both the Greek definition and the fact that swordfish do have scales when they are younger, but they harden as they grow older. And therefore, swordfish were eaten. There are some pretty scholarly articles on this issue. I think Ari Zivitovsky wrote an article about why he thinks that the swordfish is mutar, and why he thinks that most of the poskim did think it was mutar, including the Noda Yehuda, who passed in that it was fine. And then there is the Achstipias, which is the Athrius. And then the Atunas, where here it might be the tuna or the tunny fish, are ze mutar. All of those are mutar. Now, the Gemara never gives a drusha to explain what this is. Either you have to say, ain lo snapir v'kaskeset. If it doesn't have fins and scales, then it is not kosher, implying that if it hasn't at any point, it is kosher. Or the Gemara in Yevamot uses ain lo to teach you ayin alav. Check that out. So, by the case of ain lo banim, which is by someone who doesn't have children, how do we know that any offspring that exists prevents the necessity for Yibum? Because we say ayin alav. We say ain lo, check it out. So same thing over here. Ain lo snapir v'kaskeset means ayin lo. Check it out to make sure it never had snapir v'kaskeset. And that would be the drusha over here, which is ayin alav. As long as you can find at some point some snapir v'kaskeset, just like by Yibama, if you can find any offspring, that's enough. So to over here, if you can find any scales and fins, that's enough to make it into a kosher fish. And that might be the drusha that actually explains what the Gemara is saying over here. Kantanan hatom, the Mishnah in Nidah that gives us this principle, unlike our Mishnah here that says the necessity for kosher fish is to have snapir v'kaskeset, the Mishnah in Nidah says, kosher yesh lo kaskeset, yesh lo snapir. Anything that has scales has fins. V'yesh, sheyesh lo snapir, v'ein lo kaskeset. There are things that have fins, but don't have scales. Yesh lo kaskeset, v'yesh lo snapir. If it has scales, and therefore by definition it has fins, dag tohor, that's a kosher fish. Yesh lo snapir, if it has fins, v'ein lo kaskeset, but does not have scales, dag tameh. Therefore, it is a non-kosher fish, because you don't have the two features that are associated with it. Now, the problem that you have is, first of all, how do you know this is true? Where do they have this information that anything with scales on it, by definition, has fins? So Tosfot already raises that question. It says, Bim Tomar, Minayin Lahem. Where do they know this? Where do the Chachamim know this from? So Tosfot gives two possible answers. One answer is it came from Adam Arishon. Adam Arishon is the one who called names to all the animals, including the fish. So he gave names to all the fish, and he saw that all the fish that had scales, by definition, had fins to them. And therefore, all you need to know is scales. That's one way. Tosfot brings a other midrash that says they only named the animals. Doesn't say anywhere that he named the fish. And maybe there were too many fish for him to name anyway. We said in 2 days ago's daf that there were 700 types of fish. Did he really name all the fish that were out there? So according to that, the midrash, he didn't name the fish. So then how do they have this information? It says that it was Aloha the Moshe Mitzinai. So the Tosfos brings two possibilities. It's either halacha l'moshe miSinai or it's halacha mi'adam harishon. One of the two possibilities has to the source of it. The other problem that you have is that there are exceptions to the rule. There are times where you find fish that have scales that do not have fins. They are rare to find them, but you can't find such fish. So the question is, what do we do with the exceptions? So there again here are two approaches to deal with that. One approach is to say, the Chazal only said this about dagim, about fish. So there are water animals that have scales that do not have fins, but there are no fish that have scales that do not have fins. And that's the way to deal with it. It's to narrow the scope of the statement, and then the exceptions are things that are just not fish. They may be aquatic animals, but they are not fish, and therefore there's no problem with Chazal said over here. The other way to suggest it is they didn't bump into it, which is something we discussed before, is that Chazal only worried about items that they're going to come into contact with. If there exists something in Australia that has scales and doesn't have fins, it's not of interest to them only because they're never going to bump into that fish. So they're stating a principle for things that are in their locale. Just like by the Paris Vosniak, they say, in our locales, we don't have to worry about Paris Vosniak. Does that mean the Paris Vosniak are kosher? No. It just means that they didn't see a Paris Vosniak in the areas that they inhabited. Therefore, we don't worry about it. We can assume something with one Siman Tahara is not a Paris Vosniak because they don't fly, they don't live, they don't habitate in our areas. So that could be the other explanation here, which is those are explained the exceptions were things that were not indigenous to this area, which is true. All the exceptions are either from the Australian area or from America, and therefore they were not within the purview of what Chazal were speaking about. Now the Gemara says, Michtei, akaskeset kasamchinat. We are relying on the kaskasim now, because once you know that it has scales, it also has fins. If that is true, then why do you bother telling me snapir v'kaskeset, or why does the Torah bother telling us that? Just tell us kaskasim, and then we'd be done. I mean, as long as it has scales, we know what to look for, because the fins would come automatically as a package with that. Lichtov rachmana kaskeset, v'lo lichtov snapir. Just write scales and forget about fins. Ikadav rachmana kaskeset, v'lo katav snapir. Had the Torah written scales and not fins, havamina my kaskeset, snapir. I would have thought, what is the definition of the word kaskeset? Snapir, fins. Bafilu dag tameh. Then it would include even non-kosher fish. Kadav rachmana snapir v'kaskeset. It wrote both of them because it tells you that they're both fins and scales. Once you have the word fins covered by one of them, then you know that kaskeset is the other, and that means that there are scales included. V'hashtad yichtiv rachmana snapir v'kaskeset. Now that the Torah writes snapir and kaskeset, mimai, the kaskeset, the bushahu. How do you know that kaskeset is that which is on the body of the fish, that it is the scales? You're telling me that the word kaskeset, had you read in it, would be either fins or scales. We're not sure. So now that we have snapir and kaskeset, how do you know which of those two is fins and which one is scales? According to you, we could have read fins or scales into the word kaskeset, and why not say the same thing by snapir? How do you know which is which? The Gemara gives an answer, and the answer is problematic, because once you know which is which, then you can also know that kaskeset would mean scales. And that's what the Gemara says here. V'ichtiv, because it says by Goliath, v'shiryon kaskasim hu lavush. When Goliath goes out to meet David, David HaMelech, Shaul gives him his sword and gives him his armor. David HaMelech is too small to wear the armor of Shaul. He tries to walk, and he can't move inside the armor of Shaul, and he basically drops the armor and the sword. It's all too heavy for him. And then he takes his slingshot instead, and he goes against the odds. He's facing an opponent that's wearing armor and has a sword bearer in front of him, meaning that he's so big and so huge, meaning that's part of the description of Psukim over there. One of the descriptions of Psukim over there is the armor that he's wearing, including the helmet that he's wearing, and the armor. And the armor is Vishirion Kaskasim Hulavush. He's wearing chainmail armor. Chainmail armor is an advancement in armor because you don't have to wear solid metal. You can wear things that allow you to be flexible when you move, but still affords you the same protection because you have small rings of metal that protect you against being hit by an arrow or being hit by the sword. So the chainmail armor is an advancement in armor, and that's what Goliath is wearing. He's wearing shiryon, which again today is the word that's used for armored division of the armored corps, and kaskasim, which are scales. So he's wearing armor of scales, which is otherwise known as chainmail armor. Now we know what the word kaskasim means. So lichtov rachmana kaskeset, v'lo lichtov snapir. Okay, then just write kaskeset and we'd be done now. Because before you said, maybe if I just would have thought it was just fins and not scales. But now that you have the word kaskeset, and we know the definition of the word kaskeset, just write kaskeset and you'd be done. Ami Rabbi Abo, B'chein Tana Debei Rabbi Shmo, Yagdil Torah V'yadir. The very cryptic statement of the Gemara over here, Yagdil Torah V'yadir. But also it says, Harbei Amar Lanu Tamim Leida Ma'u Kaskeset. It gave us a lot of ways to come to the conclusion that kaskeset means scales. It used the word kaskeset, which we have other evidence of which means scales. Plus it wrote snapir, which also tells you that the kaskeset is not the fins, because snapir is the fins, and therefore the kaskeset is the scales. So that's what it says. It just went out of its way to make sure that you don't make a mistake. It gives you this additional information. Others suggest that yagdil toravi adir means you're right. For the halacha, you don't need that information. For the hashkafa, maybe you need that information. That's what we discussed before. With kosher animals, all the rishonim discuss why is it that certain animals are kasherim and certain animals are not. The truth is that it's a gzerat hakatuv. The Torah tells us what the simanim are, and that's it. The Torah never tells you why these are kosher and why these are not kosher. We try to come to the conclusion about what's the reason behind it. That the Rambam, the Ramban, all the rishonim try to do that. And similarly by fish, we have a similar attempt by the Rishonim to explain why these fish are kosher, why these fish are not kosher. And having both features is helpful in the understanding of why this mitzvah is this way. You're right, kaskasim by themselves would have been enough. But maybe there's some significance to snapir and kaskaset that gives you more insight as to why this fish is kosher and this fish is not kosher. That's another way to learn it. Or the Gemara uses a different terminology in other places, which is not Yagdil Torah Yadir, but Drosh V'Kabel Skar. The Torah uses the terminology with something that's not halacha, or something that was unnecessary. It says Drosh V'Kabel Skar. Make the drosh and you get skar. It gives us another opportunity to learn, and that's what it is. The Gemara here does not use that terminology, although you could read it synonymously with that concept, which is Yagdil Torah Yadir, Ein Ochanami, just more for you to learn. You get to say snapir, not just kaskeset. That's just a bonus in your limud Torah. But not that there's really any napkamina to having snapir. That's a third way to view it. But again, it's an interesting statement of the Gemara, because really the Gemara believes in the end that kaskeset is the only thing that really matters over here. All right, now we move on to a drusha that's going to carry us all the way through tomorrow's daf. It's a somewhat difficult drusha, and has major napkaminot, la halacha, in terms of water and bugs and fish in water. Psukim say over here, Etzech toklu mikol asher b'mayim. This is what you're allowed to eat from that which is in the water. Kol asher lo snapir v'kaskeset b'mayim. Anything that has fins and scales in the water. Bayamim u'benechalim. In the great bodies of waters, in the rivers. Otam tochelu. Those you can eat. V'kol asher ein lo snapir v'kaskeset. Anything that doesn't have fins and scales. Bayamim u'benechalim. In the oceans and in the rivers. Mikol sheretz b'mayim. From all those creepy, crawly things in the water, we call nefesh achaya asher b'mayim, and then it's alive in the water, sheketzeim lachem, those are impermissible if they don't have the qualifications that we mentioned over here. B'sheketz, iyu lachem, b'saram lo tochelo et b'navatam t'shaketzu. Kol, asher ein lo snapir v'kaskes b'mayim, sheketz hu lachem. Anything that does not have a snapir v'kaskeset, that is sheketz, that is problematic for you. So over here, the Torah gives two statements. It's somewhat repetitive, but beyond being repetitive, it makes it in a positive formulation and a negative formulation. As a positive formulation, is that which has fins and scales can be eaten. That which does not have fins and scales cannot be eaten. That's one extraneous factor. The other extraneous factor is the way the pasuk begins. It says, "Etzeh tochlu mikol asher b'mayim." And then it says, "Kol asher snapir v'kaskeset b'mayim." So the word b'mayim seems extraneous over there, because it says mayim again, and number two is, it says at the end of the pasuk, tochelu. So had I skipped the first part of that pasuk, it says, etzeh tochlu mikol asher b'mayim. Had I left that out, and just began the pasuk, kol asher lo snapir v'kaskeset b'mayim v'yamim v'nachalim otam tochelu, you would have gotten the same information without an introductory phrase. So the Gemara is going to point out that that introductory phrase is also extraneous. The question is, what do we do with all of this information that's been given to us in the psukim? And that's the nature of the braita that we're about to bring right now. Tana Rabbanan, Mimashma Shenemar Achol Et Sheyeshlo. Since the Torah tells you eat that which has fins and scales, Shomeani, I could infer from that, Al Tochal Et Sheinlo. Then you don't eat things that don't have them. Mimashma Shenemar Al Tochal Et Sheinlo. Or if the Torah tells you, don't eat those things that don't have eis nafir bekeskeset, meaning a double negative, shemei ani achol etsheishlo, then you can, from a double negative, infer a positive, which is, those that do have nafir bekeskeset, you should eat. Lama shanan. Why did the Torah repeat them? Why did it formulate it both in the positive and in the negative? La'abor alav ba'asei velotasei. To tell you, when you violate it, there are two restrictions over here. We have a similar thing by the behemah. By the behemah, it says anything that has split hooves and chews its gut is kosher. Anything that does not have it is problematic. And there the Gemara says also, there's an asei and a lav. The asei is, eat these items. And the lav that is inferred from that is what's called a lav haba miklal asei. And it has a status like an asei. Lav haba miklal asei is an asei. So from the positive formulation, you have a negative inference. That negative inference is considered to be an assay. From the negative formulation, you have a negative statement, a lota assay. And therefore, from eating fish that do not have fins and scales, you'll be in violation of an assay and a lota assay. Both of them. That both comes with stringencies that are associated with it. It also has certain policy implications in terms of assay doka lota assay may not work in these situations because you have an assay and a lota assay. It also has napkamina in terms of malkot. Again, it also has possibilities of issues with regards to hatra. So then, the Gemara says, tochlu mikol asher b'mayim. That's the introductory phrase to the pasuk that we saw before. And then it says, tochlu mikol asher b'mayim. Ma tamad lomar. What do you need that introductory phrase for at all? Sheyachol. Hoel v'hiter b'mifurash v'hiter b'stam. Since the Torah is matir explicitly, and then is matir non-explicitly, just like when it explicitly identified for us what is mutar, it only did it in kelim. Stam, so too, when it was matir without giving any specification, it only is matir it by kelim. That statement of the Gemara will be explicated on in tomorrow's daf. Not going to spend time on it. The Gemara will try to figure out what is satum and what is the mifurash and which one is being learned from which. Minayin the rabot. Barot, shichim, umeorot. How do I know now to include these types of water bodies, which are like cisterns, caves, places where water has gathered? Sheshocheh, vishotemehen, that you can just bend over and drink from them. Veinu nimna, and you don't have to worry what goes into your mouth. Tamalomar, tochlu, mikol asher b'mayim. That is that introductory phrase that is brought there. Asher b'mayim. It's a tohu mikol asher b'mayim. All right. So now we have here a braita that gave us a lot of information, and now we're going to kind of dissect the braita in order to understand what is being said over here. The things that we noted already are the extraneous nature of the psukim, and that's what the Gemara is focused on. Focused on the fact that it formulates it both in the positive and negative, to say there's an essay and a lot essay. Also focused on the fact that the introductory phrase of was unnecessary. And the truth is, and Rashi points this out, Tosfot mentions it as well, that the introductory phrase is not really the one that is extraneous. The extraneous is the second phrase. That's the way it usually works. The first one you need, the second one is extraneous. So then why does the braita focus on the first one being extraneous? Rashi says, because otherwise there'd be no drasha. The whole drasha, as we're going to see, as it develops now, all comes from the fact that in the first part of the pasuk, it doesn't give any definition as to the mayim that we're speaking about. And that's going to come pivotal in understanding the drasha over here. But so Rashi says that had you stated that the second part of the pasuk is extraneous, you wouldn't be able to learn anything. So therefore, the Gemara assumes that the second part of the pasuk is the gufei. That's what you need. And the first part of the pasuk is extraneous. And from there, we come to a drasha. The drasha we came to is that barot, shechim, and ma'arot, you're allowed to drink from them. You're allowed to bend down, stick your mouth in the water, and start drinking from that water, and not worry about what's coming into your mouth at that time. Meaning that even if there are non-kosher fish inside of that water, or non-kosher aquatic animals that are there, as long as you're drinking the water directly from the water there, you drink it, it wouldn't be problematic. And similarly, kelim also would be fine as well, which is that if you find these items inside of a kelim, you're taking a cup and drinking it, and it happens to have some aquatic life in it that you didn't see before, and you drink it, that'd be fine. Those are the two statements of the braita, that kelim are okay, and borot, shechim, and marot are also okay. That's all we know. Now the Gemara wants to understand. Heichin hitir b'kelim. Where is it written that kelim are okay? I mean, the Braita made an assumption that if it's in kelim, you don't have to worry about drinking it. Whatever's in there is fine. Tichtiv, because the pasuk says, etzeh tochlo mikol asher b'mayim, b'yamim u'banachalim. That is defined or qualified by the statement by Yamim and Achalim. Who? Dechi lei achol. Delei lei lo teichol. If it has fins and scales, you eat it. Doesn't have fins and scales, you don't eat it. Ha? Huh? The inference would be, b'kelim. Apagav delei lei achol. Even if it doesn't have fins and scales, you're allowed to eat it. Meaning that what they're saying is, the pasuk says, etzeh tochlo mikol asher b'mayim. Kol asher lo snapir mekaskeset b'mayim. Anything that has fins and scales in the water. What waters? Bayamim u'menachalim. Otam. Only those. Tochelu. Those are the only ones that require fins and scales. Nothing else requires fins and scales. That means if you're drinking out of a kli, it doesn't have to have fins and scales in order for you to eat it. Where it says, Ema, bikelim, apgav de'itlei lo techol. Why don't you learn it this way? There's clearly a miut of yamim u'menachalim. How did you know to make the miut in the way that Yamim Nachalim requires fins and scales. Kelim don't. Do just the opposite. Yamim Nachalim, if it has fins and scales, you can eat it. But Kelim, you can't even eat it if it has fins and scales. It doesn't help you whatsoever. Gemara says, Lo Salkadatko. You can't say that. Dichtiv. Because the subsequent pasuk, which we read before, which is, Mikol Asher Ein Lo Snapir Bekaskeset Bayamim Nachalim, Mikol Asher Etzamayim Bayamim Ubenachalim, Delay Lay Lo Techol. The deal from there is that which is in the Yamim and Nachalim that don't have fins and scales, you may not drink. Ha b'kelim, inference that you make there is, apagav deletlei achol. Even though it doesn't have it, you can eat it. So what the Gemara is doing at this point is saying is you have another pasuk. Both psukim have a qualification. That is, the pasuk that says you must have fins and scales is qualified by Yamim and Nachalim. The pasuk that says that you don't have to have fins and scales is also qualified by Yamim and Nachalim. And so, the only way to understand this is to say that when it says b'yamim u'nechalim, when you don't need fins and scales, that's saying it's limited to yamim u'nechalim, where you don't have fins and scales, you cannot eat it. But if it wasn't yamim u'nechalim, for instance, it was kelim, you'd be able to eat it even without fins and scales. And therefore, the understanding in the first pasuk, when it says that you have fins and scales b'yamim u'nechalim, means only in the yamim u'nechalim do you require fins and scales. But in kelim, you don't require fins and scales. Not that you can't eat them at all, but they don't require fins and scales, and therefore you can now reconcile the two psukim. The inference from both psukim now matches up. The truth is that the Baal Tosfos asked this question, is that you could have done it just the opposite way around. You have two statements in the Torah, and one of them you're taking in an absolute sense, and one of them you are being medayek from, you're taking out of its inference. Which is that, b'yamim u'nechalim otam techelu, but not those ones that don't have snapir and keskeset. And then from that deal of those that don't have snapir and keskeset, that's only true by yamim and achalim, not true in the kelim. So you're going to learn the deal directly from the second pasuk, which is that only by yamim and achalim is the lack of snapir and keskeset problematic. In kelim, it is fine. That's a direct deal from the pasuk. And then the first pasuk, you're going to make a deal from the deal, which is that you need snapir and keskeset in yamim and achalim. And that means that if you don't have snapir v'kaskeset b'yamim u'nechalim, it's problematic. But that's only problematic in yamim u'nechalim, not in kelim. And that way you can reconcile the two psukim. The Baal Tosfos would say that why can't you just do that in the opposite? Meaning that the same could be true if you just read it the opposite way around and you would have ended up with the same result. One of the psukim you have to be dayek from the pasuk itself, and one of them you have to be dayek from the diuk. So why not just read it that the second pasuk that says, don't eat those items that don't have a snapir v'kaskeset in yamim v'nachalim, and then you can be medayek from that, which means that if it has snapir v'kaskeset, you're allowed to eat it in yamim v'nachalim. But that's only true in yamim v'nachalim. In kelim, you can't even eat it if it has snapir v'kaskeset. And then in the first pasuk, you'd be medayek. Yesh lo snapir v'kaskeset in yamim v'nachalim, that is kasher. But that means in kelim, snapir v'kaskeset are not enough. And then you'd be able to match the psukim, just doing it in the opposite way. Whether you medayek from the direct pasuk, or you medayek from the diuk out of the pasuk. If you just flip and just do that with the negative instead of the positive, you'd end up with the opposite conclusion. So the Baal Tosafot answer in the end that since it says otam tochelu, it's as if it's written in the first pasuk, otherwise you may not eat them. It's not as if it says otam tochelu, those you may eat. Then you're medayek, that those that don't have snapir v'kaskeset you may not eat, but that's only b'yamim nachalim. And then kelim don't have that restriction. Rather, Otam Tokel makes it as if it's written explicitly in that pasuk. If it doesn't have Sefir Meketzkeset, don't eat it. And therefore, it's also a diuk directly from the pasuk and not a diuk from the diuk. And in that way, the two psukim reconcile in a much more simple fashion, which is that the latter pasuk that says, those that are miyamim minachalim, if they don't have Sefir Meketzkeset, you can't eat them. In the Kelim, you can't eat them. And the first pasuk is saying almost the same thing, which is Sefir Meketzkeset are needed in yamim minachalim, and those you can eat. But it says, Otam Tokelu. Otam Tokelu is if it's written, but if they don't have them, then you may not eat them. And it's as if it's written by Yamim and Achalim, you may not eat things that don't have Snapir Vikaskeset. And that would lead you to the Diuk that Vikalim, it would be fine. And that's why the Gemara went in this direction instead of the opposite direction. Vema Bamaim Klau. Why don't we say the word Maim is a generic statement? Vayamim and Achalim Prat. Yamim and Achalim is a detail. Klau Uprat. Ein Bechlau Elimashim Parprat. That'd be a Klau Uprat. The Klau Uprat then is defined by the prat. The klal is defined by the prat. It's as if it's written a colon. And here is the definition of the klal. Yamimu nechalim in. That means that wadis of water, over there you do have a requirement of fins and scales. Ni'itzim vicharitzim lo. Before we said that kelim are clearly out of the picture here. Then we said boril tshichim and me'arot are also out of the picture because of etzeh tochlo. And now you're going to try to say that ni'itzim and charitzim are also out of the picture, which again, Rashi is going to define for us on tomorrow's daf what exactly these are, but generally they are trenches and gutters or channels of water, and that they are certain mechanisms for moving water, as opposed to borot shechim and meorot, which are ways to store water. The water is generally not moving so much, but it's generally a storage of water, versus nitzim and charitzim, which are used for storing water, but they're also used to move the water, or the water moves more within these items. Then you would have now had many more items where there's no requirement for fins and scales. It says, Bamaim Chazar V'Klau. It's actually a Klau Upratu Klau. If you look in the pasuk, there is no such Klau Upratu Klau, and the pasuk says the following. It's there, Tuklu Mikol Asher Bamaim, that's the first Maim. Kol Asher Slo Stampir Mekaskese Bamaim, that's the second Maim. Then, by Yamim and Nechalim, that's the Prat. The two Klaus, the Mayim and Mayim, are before you ever get to the Prat. It's not a Klau Uprat Uklau, it's a Klau Klau Uprat. So the Gemara says, Hane Tre Klale, the Smichela Adade Ninu. Those are two Klalim that are adjacent to each other. There's no Klau Uprat Uklau, it's a Klau Klau Uprat. Amravina, Kidamre Bimarova, that's what they say in Eretz Yisrael. Koma Kom Shatam Otsesh Ne Klalot Asmuchim Zelazeh. Whenever you find two generic statements that are adjacent to each other, hatel prat benehem, stick the prat in between them, vidona miklal uprat uklal, and then make them into a klal uprat uklal. So you would have thought klal uprat would have limited it to just yamim and nechalim only. Any other body of water then would not have the restriction of snafir v'kaskeset. Along comes the Gemara and says, you have to learn it as a klal uprat uklal. Klal uprat uklal means ke'en aprat. You have to be similar to yamim and nechalim. Now, what's similar to yamim and nechalim would be anything besides kelim. That would have included nitzim and charitzim for sure, because they're close to being like yamim and nechalim. And it would have included borot shechim u'me'arot. It would also included those items as well. So now you have all the items would have been included in the klal uprat uklal. So here, the Gemara is willing to include in the prat borot shechim and marot, even though they're not identical to the prat of yamim and nechalim. So Rashi says over here, that's apagav the goldami lay the prato, even though it's not identical to the prat, ela b'chad zad, by one side, meaning it only has one thing in common with it, marbinan, we include it to klala batra dafka. As opposed to what we saw in the Tanakh debate, Rabbi Shmuel in the previous sugya, where they said klala kama is dafka, over here they're saying that the klala Batra is dafka, which means that you really start out with prat uklal, which would include everything, and then klal just limits that somewhat. And that means that in the prat, you'd include everything you could, possibly, into the prat, to maximize what the prat would take, even things that are not identical to the prat, or don't have all the features in common. Even if they have some features in common, we would include it. Except for the fact that you have etzet ukubamayim. That's the miut that the Braita said. That comes to tell you that not everything is included under yamim and nechalim. And so what it does is it mitigates or it tempers the Kein HaPrat over here. The Kein HaPrat would have been included everything. Yamim and Nechalim, which are written. Nitzim and Karitzim, which are very similar to it. And even Borot, Shechim and Marot, which aren't so similar to it. And all those would be included in areas that require snapir because kesef. Along comes etzet tochlu mikol asher b'mayim and tells you, temper the prat a little bit. The prat is going to include things that are identical or very similar to it. That means nitzim and charitzim. It's not going to include borot shechim and me'arot. And it tells you that the prat is limited over here. The Gemara is going to develop that. I'm going to read it in. I'm just giving you the big picture of what's about to happen. So Tosafot says, why doesn't the Gemara just answer here? Instead of saying that you need etzet tochlu mikol asher b'mayim, could just answer that this Tana holds that klal kama is dafka. If you hold klal kama is dafka, then yamim and nechalim could only include nitzim and charitzim. It could not include borot, shechim, and marot, because they're not similar enough to the prat. Similar to what Tana Debei Rebbe Shmuel did at the beginning of today's daf. If it wasn't exactly alike it, then it wasn't included. So it's over here. You could have answered the question not by through the riboy. You could have added through klal kama dafka. Tosafot says over here, Eino Chanami, you could have used that explanation, but the Gemara is trying to explain it according to this Braita that uses etzet tochlu mikol asher b'mayim to explain it. Therefore, they are doing it based on the fact that the klal batra is dafka, not la klal kama, as Rashi stated. And so the Gemara is following that logic in order to do it. Tosafot on the previous stuff also mentioned the fact that the Gemara likes to ensure that we can explain it according to both views, both the klal kama dafka and klal Batra dafka, and therefore it gives both explanations, meaning that this works even according to one who says klal batra dafka. That is b'mayim klal, b'yamim nechalim prat, b'mayim chazaru klal, klal upratu klal, iatadana ugena prat. Ma prat mifurash mayim novim, just like the prat mifurash, we're talking about moving water. Abkol mayim novim. So too, any moving water is going to be included. My rabbi, what are you going to include here? Nitzim, v'charitzim, and nitzim, li'isura. That's going to include nitzim, v'charitzim, because those are waters that are moving. They're similar to yamim and nechalim. My miyate, what is not going to be included in this prat? Borot, shichim, and me'orot, which are water captures. They're a place where the water is static or stationary. They're not going to be included. Lehetero, therefore they do not have a requirement of snapir v'kaskasin, and anything that comes out of them is going to be fine. Ve'ema, how do you know that that's the prat? Ma prat mifurash mayim gdelim al gabe karka. Why don't you say that the prat is water on land? Meaning that the oceans and the rivers are water that sit on the land. Afko mayim gdelim al gabe karka. So to any body of water that is on the land will be included. That means, my rabbi, afilu borot shechim me'arot li'isura. That would include then, nitzim and charitzim, borot shechim me'arot, my miyek. The only thing left out would be, Mi'et kelim. Kelim would be the only thing that's not included, because that's not a la karka. That's water inside of a utensil. Imkein tochlu mayahani le. This is what I said before. That's what the mi'u does. Then the extraneous term, etzet tochlu mikol asher b'mayim, what did it do for you? It didn't change anything. Without it, you would have known that kelim are mutarim, and everything else is asur. It has to be making a contribution over here. That contribution is telling you that temper the prat. The prat should only include nitzim and charitzim. It should not include borot, shechim, and marot. And that means now you have two categories. You have a category of borot, shechim, marot, and kelim, which are mutarim. And then you have a category of things that are asurim, which are yamim, nechalim, nitzim, and charitzim. Those are all asurim. And that means that only in yamim, nechalim, nitzim, and charitzim do you need snapir because keset. Whereas if you are in a kelim, or you're in a bor, shiach, and me'ara, over there, you do not require snapir v'kaskasin. Now that doesn't mean that you can just eat anything that comes out of those waters. You can pick it out and take it out. It sounds like from the Gemara that you have to bend down and you drink in the water directly from those items. This is what Rashi says. Minayim atir borot shechim imarot. Listen carefully. She'enu nimna lishtot imatolaim shebehem. Don't worry about drinking the waters with the worms that are in it. Ho vein domim liyamim nechalim. Since they're not in the Yamim and Nechalim, she'asiminim amurim em. The demand for snapir v'kaskeset is only when you're in a Yamim, Nechalim, Nitzim, Charitzim, and you're in a bor, shiach, me'ara. So the Gemara said, if you bend down and you drink from them, you don't need to worry about whatever comes into your mouth. Keep drinking. Don't worry about what comes into your mouth. And same with the keli. Drink whatever's in there. Don't worry about what's in the water. If you have water in a kli, or you put your mouth to the water of a cave water or whatever water is being stored there, and certain things come into your mouth while you're drinking, Those aren't going to be problematic. There's no demand for snapir v'kaskeset in those cases. From what I'm reading here, I think there are two things. One is, it has to be the size of which, when you drink directly from the water, it goes into your mouth. And it can't be something that's so large that you have to bite it or you have to break it in order to eat it. It has to be something that goes whole into your mouth along with the water. I would say that's one. And number two is, it seems from this, that you have to be drinking directly from the water, not that you're picking this thing out of the water. That would exclude many items that otherwise you would have thought of as being non-kosher just because they don't fit that billing. But there are smaller items that would come out with that, and you don't have to worry about it. You don't have to look so carefully when you're drinking the water as to what's in the water. Right now, to your question about waters, or why do people worry about filtering on waters? Two issues that you have with water, and you have to deal with both of those issues before it becomes a problem. One problem is this yamim or nichalim, or is it not considered to be yamim or nichalim? It's clear here that if it's not yamim or nichalim, then you don't have to worry about the issue, because anything that's in barot, shechim, and marot, or in kelim, you don't have to worry about these issues of snapir, v'kaskeset, or drinking the toldaim that are in the, such waters. So the question is, that water that comes out of your tap, what is the status of that water? Has that water now changed its status because it came through piping? And that piping is defined as kelim, or came through a water tower, and that's considered to be barot, shechim, and marot? Or do we say, since it's still attached to the source, which means that it's a continuous flow from the source all the way through, even though it touches different items along the way, it's still really, when you turn on your tap, in the end, the water's coming from the rivers, the lakes, from the reservoirs, that you really have a direct line back to there, even though it's passing through different utensils along the way. So that obviously would have a huge nafkamina. If you think you're still attached to the source, then you're still in yamim and nechalim, and it would be a problem. If you think you've already shut off the source, and now you are in a new state, which is that you're in kelim now, then barot, shechim, emarot, and kelim are not subject to this, and then the issue wouldn't be a real issue. Secondarily, if you believe that it is yamim and nechalim, and it is a problem, the second problem is it has to be visible. Anything that is not visible is not problematic. If you can't see it, then you can't be a sur, because the Torah is no the Malachi Asherate. You don't have to use a microscope. You don't have to use something to find things that are not visible by the naked eye. And therefore, if it's not visible to the naked eye, it wouldn't be a problem. Over here, the issue is that you actually cannot see these worms or bugs that are found in the drinking water. What you can't see is that when you have a bunch of them together, when they're there, there's some sort of white film or white residue that is in the water. The question is that enough to be considered visible? They're visible because you can make out that there's something there. But the something that's there, you can't make out that it is actually a worm or some sort of live organism. And so is that enough to be considered visible? So that's all the machlok is about. It's about these two points. One point is the water you're drinking defined as being from yamim nechalim or from kelim? That'd be the first thing. If you say kelim, nothing to talk about. You don't have to worry about it at all. If you say yamim nechalim, then you go to the next point in the decision tree. It has to be visible to be problematic. Now, these are clearly not visible organisms because they're microorganisms. They're getting through filters. I mean, they're getting through the city filters. They're getting through what the public works do anyway. So they're pretty small to start with, and they're not visible. But they have streaks or little things that are visible but are not able to be made out as organisms. Is that considered to be visible? Is that not considered to be visible? If it's not considered to be visible, then again, it's not a problem. If it's considered to be visible, then you have an issue, and then you would need to filter them out. So that's the decision tree. You'd have to get both past the point that it is considered to be yamim and nechalim and not kelim. And you have to get past the point that it's considered to be visible, even though they're not absolutely visible. There's just some semblance of them that is visible. Is that enough to make it a sur? And that's really the controversy that exists over the waters that have these problems in them. And a number of years ago, the waters in New York City were subject to this issue because of this exact problem of finding these streaks of white in the water, which were actually microorganisms, which are not dangerous or problematic, but nevertheless, it could have created a kosher problem if you think all the qualifications exist to make that into a problematic tolat in terms of drinking the water. Okay, we're going to stop here. 11 lines down on the top of Samach Zayin Amud Aleph.